All right, let's pray. Can we stand for a change, stretch a bit for the next hour? Our Father in heaven, we come to you this morning. We're so grateful that you have set aside a day, that we come to you and draw our thoughts and our hearts, our minds, our will towards you, and we avail ourselves to you're speaking to us today, God. I pray that you would do that. There are many things we can grasp at, but are futile to reach, lest you reach and reveal. And God, I pray for that mercy this morning, that you would reveal from heaven to our tiny viewpoints something of you, that we can grow thereby and have our souls and our minds and our hearts enlarged. Give us that gift, God. We truly ask for it. I pray that we can have hearts that receive. And God, do your work here. Commit the next hour to your glory. May you do what you will. By your mercy, in Jesus' name, amen. Okay, I brought two of my creations here. It's Bob and Bill. So I made Bob. Oh, I thought I might be able to put them up here. You'll have to, as I go through the message, you'll have to imagine them. You won't be able to see them. I was going to prop them. So this is Bill. And this is Bob. I made them. And I told them when I made them, I will be your human and you will be my stick person. That's our agreement. It's gone fairly well, but we ran into trouble of late. They don't like the plans I have for them. I was going to bring them here and show them, and they didn't want to be here. They wanted to be somewhere else. So we had a bit of a conflict, but we straightened it out. And in the last bit, they've also deemed me egotistical for having my way with them. They think I'm a bit arrogant and can't understand why I'm dominating them and bossing them around. So they've started to push back, the two of them. And in one more recent wrinkle development, they got together with all their friends and they all decided, all of them together, that I don't exist, but we'll figure that out later, what to do with them. But yeah, now they're all sure I don't exist. So, but we'll let that be. I wish I could prop them up here, but I just imagine them. They're sitting here looking at me. So we'll just leave that there. Yeah, we're having tension in the relationship, but as of now, in their mind, I'm not here. They're running their own program, doing their own life. Oh, and Bob thinks he's much more handsome than Bill, because Bill has this darker hands. I don't know if you can see it, but Bill's hands are much darker. Thanks, Jess. If they die, then it's on you. They're pretty fragile. So Bill has a dark hands, and Bob doesn't. And he's pretty proud about that and feels very superior, still alive. He's very superior to Bob because there's these major differences in them. But for me, I regard them the same, dark cross member, dark hands or not. So let's leave them here. Thanks, Jess. It's perfect. So Bob and Bill will be our illustration as we go through. So this illustration breaks down somewhat between me and them and us and God. And I'm not sure what you're thinking, how it breaks down, but I hope by the end of the message you'll see how this illustration just is way out of balance between me and them. And me and God, that picture is very, very much off balance. So the other thing, I just want to put that out as a pegboard. My message today is the problem of God. The problem of God. And for those that have read this book, I read an excerpt a few months ago. The Knowledge of the Holy, also the Attributes of God and Their Meaning in the Christian Life by A.W. Tozer. I'll be reading a fair bit from here. I finished my study of Jesus, which was a tremendous blessing to me. And I learned a lot of who God is and who Christ is, the relation, the glory of God, how important it is. And with that, it opened up Jesus' attitude towards his Father, of Jesus himself taking zero glory, zero. He kept deflecting it upwards. That got me thinking of who is God. And in reading this book, something awakened in me that I want to explore this theme of the attributes of God, who he is, and I'll probably be doing that in the next months and maybe years. But this is a very quick introduction to that endeavor. So when I say the problem of God, I don't mean the problem with God. There is no problem with God anywhere, ever, at any time, nor will there ever be a problem with God. The problem of God is us to him. The problem of God. I'd like to tell you a quick story of what happened this week. I drive truck these days. I'm hauling water. And I was taking water from the West St. Paul yard over this way, and I was driving on number 8 and heading west on 67. And as I was driving west, I have a triaxle truck, and it was fully loaded with water, 25,000 liters, decent bit of weight. And I was doing probably 100K, 105 on 67 heading west, and this black minivan came blasting down a dirt road. I would say it was doing 130, I would guess, on a dirt road approaching 67. And it was fast enough that I picked up, what is this guy doing? He's obviously not wise, put it that way. And he was going way too fast, and we were approaching each other. And at the end, he did slow down somewhat, but I don't know when he started. I couldn't quite see. A lot of dust. And he was going way, way, way too fast. So he ended up sliding onto over the gravel shoulder and the dirt mixture there, and he slid onto 67, literally right in my lane. And as he's sitting there looking at me, we're probably from here to the wall apart, maybe a bit more, maybe double that, but that's a short distance for what I'm thinking of. Again, I'm totally loaded. I'm doing 110, 105, and we're just now approaching each other. So as he's sitting there looking at me out his driver's window, I've got a big truck, it's got a big grill, and I'm really coming, and the distance is like dramatically closing. So I'll just leave that there, but this guy has a few decisions to make here. And in light of who God is in our world, sometimes man takes a very odd approach to that problem of God. So like my truck approaching his driver's door at whatever speed it is, at whatever distance it is, if the guy had said, this situation is too big, too shocking, too incomprehensible, too life-altering, too much to process, he's just overwhelmed with it. His option could be to take out his phone and check his Facebook feed. He could do that. Or he could look for his coffee and take a sip. That option is there. And as we go through God in some sense, and again, this is just scratching as I'll be reading that, what is mankind's response to the problem of God? And I'd just like to leave those illustrations up as pegboards. Bob and Bill will be here looking at you. And me approaching this guy, and he's faced with a severe and dreadful circumstance, what is he going to do with that? So let's leave that out. Humankind. So I'm not talking about anybody in particular, of course, but I'm talking to everybody in another sense, including myself. So we don't know how to deal with the problem of God. It's too much. And all of us check out at a certain point. Proverbs 9:10 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. So the absolute base point of anything is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. So that's the absolute base point that we have to go there to start from. And I'd like to read here in the preface of the book, and I'll be reading quite a bit from it. So hopefully it's not going to be boring. And the other thing I want to say is mankind has unfortunately degenerated in their thinking. Have you ever looked at a book written in the 1900s? Maybe, I don't know, Shakespeare or what older classics? When was Dickens written? Who has ever read him? Older books, like classic books from the 1900s, 1880s, somewhere in there. The language is surprising. You wouldn't think that that language had come from there. It looks like modern, very smart, well-written, well-articulated, deep thoughts, like there's much in there that you wouldn't expect to be 100, 150 years old. And as you go further back, sometimes you read a sentence from the older writings, and you kind of take for granted that we are supposed to be smarter and more brilliant, but if you take what they had, how did they come up with it? And back then, people could graduate university by young, like 5 or 7 years younger than what we do now. And I read a grade 8 test a while back, a few years ago. Grade 8, the list of questions that their exam had on it. And some of the concepts I couldn't hardly get the concept, never mind do the work. And that was a grade 8 test that was normal, I think 150 years ago. So we think we're getting smarter and more brilliant, but just case in point, when phones first came out, we had to dial numbers. We didn't look at Nick and touch Nick and it would dial for us. We remembered the numbers. And most of us had, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 numbers memorized comfortably. I need to call home. I need to call work. And we'd go through it. Now I have about 4 numbers memorized, which is probably pretty classic. So it doesn't mean we're getting dumber, but our computing, memory, thinking, reasoning, deep processing power is diminishing as a society very, very much. Critical thinking is going on a nosedive. So we think we're getting smarter. We're definitely not. Definitely not. And yes, computers are doing thinking, and we're able to do more, like computer modeling. To be able to fly a jet with a computer before building it and testing it is good. To be able to know how much stress a piece of aluminum can take when you load it up over how much time before building the car, that's a good thing to have computer modeling. But on the flip side, if we're giving our mental capacity away, and for me, the topic of AI is doing that. People are giving the last bit of value. So we've given and given and given. But once we give our mind and deep thinking, deep computing power away to a machine, it just reduces a human being to, I don't know, a cow maybe, something that is just nothing left. So whenever you say to your something, hey, something, think for me, it's actually a very dangerous thing to do, biblically, morally, and eternally. Because the last thing we have is our comprehension, our computing of who God is, how God is, what this life means. When we read a psalm, I was reading Psalm 145, and let me do that, and do this exercise with me. In your mind, as I read Psalm 145, just exercise, be honest with yourself, but think at what point that your mind simply clicks off. You know that you're not computing what it's saying. And I was surprised at myself of how quickly this happened. So at whatever point you honestly feel that I'm not getting, there's infinitely more than I'm able to do, and your mind simply clicks off. Let me do this. I will extol thee, my God, O King. So the concept of king, the grandness of it, that's a small one. I will bless thy name forever and ever. Every day I will bless thee. I will praise thy name forever and ever. I'm sure you're still all with me. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. His greatness is unsearchable. So if you're normal, the greatness is unsearchable. We try, I think we reach for most of us, and we can't quite do it, but we're still trying to hang on. Your greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise thy works to another. In other words, we're going to mine out everything that we can. My children will mine out everything, and it'll still not be a start, and shall declare thy mighty acts. I will speak of the glorious honor of thy majesty and thy wondrous works. And men shall speak of the might of thy terrible acts, terrible in a good word, and declare thy greatness. They shall abundantly utter the memory of thy great goodness and shall sing of thy righteousness. The Lord is gracious, full of compassion. So at this point, I'm lost. I just can't be where he is. I can't comprehend what he's doing and saying. To me, the words are far bigger than what I'm able to get out. And my mind just simply disengages because I can't reach it. And there's many things here. Thy kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. To mine out even what that could mean, its ramifications, what it would mean for my life, what it would mean for the planet, how do you process thy kingdom as an everlasting kingdom? In other words, when Trump is finished, or if China takes over and China rises and falls, or in the days of the Bible where we read about the Babylonian rise and the Egyptians, and God simply reigned completely, absolutely unchallenged. All the Bobs and Bills could do what they want, but God was still completely, absolutely unchallenged at the top of it. Absolutely untouched by huge kingdoms, hundreds of year-long kingdoms, powerful things that changed the planet. And God was not even begun to be challenged with that process. Not even begun to be challenged. Thy kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and thy dominion endureth throughout all generations. So again, we try the best that we can with our minds, and we can't do it. And the dumber that man becomes, and I don't mean this in a mean way, but dumb simply being not able to think. And sometimes we use the word stupid in an insulting way, but stupid would simply be not being able to think. And we are, as people, getting to a place where we, in some cases, often hardly are able to think anymore, but on the flip side, we don't want to. Phone, scroll, press, funny cat videos, fail, hockey. We just don't want to engage in the big picture of life, and especially the problem of God. But as we think of this guy sitting in his minivan and I'm approaching him, that is a small thing in light of the problem of God in our life, in our generation, in our society, in our planet, and in our universe. The problem of God is a big, severe, dreadful problem. So Proverbs 9-10, I read that. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, just in preface. I'd like to read something that I read, a few months ago. But let me do that here. So there's a condition that existed in the church, general church, for some years, and is steadily growing worse. By the way, this book was written in 1950 or 60. So this is now 70-ish years old. This is a 70-year-old book. And I refer to the loss of the concept of majesty from the popular religious mind. The church has surrendered her once lofty concept of God and has substituted it for one so low, so ignoble, as to be utterly unworthy of thinking, worshiping men. This she has done not deliberately, but little by little, without her knowledge, and her very unawareness only makes her situation all the more tragic. We forget that it's God that we're dealing with. The low view of God entertained almost universally among Christians is a cause of 100 lesser evils everywhere amongst us, from a whole new philosophy of the Christian life that has resulted from this one basic error in our religious thinking. With our loss of the sense of majesty has come the further loss of religious awe and consciousness of the divine presence. We have lost our spirit of worship, simply recognizing God is God and I am man. And what these two would do to me, to simply find your place, not fighting, not arguing, not pushing, but simply relaxing in the place that God has put us in, and not trying to be equal, not trying to fight, not trying to take our own way, our own plan, that is completely foreign to reality. They're not going to fight me. And when they think they can, they're just not in reality. It's not a question of will or might. It's what's real. And mankind is that to God. So worship, simply recognizing the grandeur and the bigness, the vastness of God, and our ability to withdraw inwardly to meet God in adoring silence. And that will come. In Revelation, things will be righted again, and that will be complete again. Worship and our ability to meet God in adoring silence. Modern Christianity is simply not producing the kind of Christian who can appreciate or experience life in the Spirit. The words, be still and know that I am God, mean next to nothing in the self-confident, bustling worshiper in this middle period of the 20th century. Again, 1971. And the world has gone dramatically different since then. So, how do we, as humans, come to any, even if it's faint, vague idea, of who God actually is. I'll read again here. Were we able to extract from any man a complete answer to the question, what comes into your mind when you think about God? We might predict with certainty the spiritual future of that man. Were we able to know exactly what our most influential religious leaders think of God today, we might be able to, with some precision, foretell where the church will stand tomorrow. In other words, what we think of God today, those that lead, those that preach, those that teach, if you could mine down what our actual view of God is, that will be where the church will be. If it's low, the church will be low. If it's high, the church will be high. It's in direct correlation. And then, all the problems of heaven and earth, so septic problems, flat tires, bad teeth, financial woes, vehicles not working, health issues, family tension, all the problems of heaven and earth, if they were to confront us together and at once, would be nothing compared to the overwhelming problem of God, that He is and what He is like and what we as moral beings must do about Him. So I think for sake of time, I'll just leave that there. And again, I'm simply scratching at this. So in Exodus 3, we go there, Exodus 3. As a boy, I always wondered what this meant. I couldn't quite decipher it, and I think I have some more understanding of it. But in Exodus 3, when God sent Moses to Pharaoh, Moses said, who am I telling Pharaoh? And Moses knew who Pharaoh was. He knew his power. From a human standpoint, he was there. He knew what he could command, what he could do, what he was like, what his personality was, Moses said to God, behold, when I come to the children of Israel and say unto them, to what authority shall I go and say I'm rescuing them by what am I answering? The God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they shall say, what is his name? What shall I say unto them? So he's saying, by what authority am I to embark on this endeavor to rescue these people that have been crying to you for 400 years? What's my credentials? What's the credibility here? What's the power? Like, what am I appealing to on their behalf? And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am, hath sent me unto you. And that, in God's mind, was a complete and absolute and utter picture of complete and complete and complete and complete power. That will be enough. The I am sent you. There's no more needed than that phrase. And to God, that was enough. So what did God mean when he said, I am that I am? And as a boy, I was like poetry. Sometimes you hear it and say it to yourself and mean something quaint, but not sure what. Sounds neat, but what does actually mean? I don't know. But I think it's simply saying, I am. So if I would say, I am Jason, or I am, and give my job, or the thing that I am is so-and-so, and usually add something, a painter or a father. But he's saying, the thing that I am is the I am. So there's two separate I ams happening, I think. And the I am simply means I always was, always will be, I am present. There's no changing. And with that comes many, many different, you can trail that out in many different avenues. So God made all that is around us. I'll just leave that out as well as a note and get back to it in a bit. So God is. When God says that He is, I am, God is, and all the rest followed. Everything except God isn't I am. God is the only thing that is I am, because He, in that self-contained complete package, made the rest. So when we think of God as being created, we're not thinking of God properly, because everything else is from Him, and He's the only thing that is not made. So there's two distinct separate things. Everything that is made is not God, because God was complete and intact and then made and distributed everything else. So all the rest followed. It started, it began. God did not start, and God did not begin. He was, always, always will be. And when we even use those words, they have a measure of time in them, so it's actually incorrect. That's why God says, I am. Because was starts somewhere and goes back to there. Will be starts here and goes forward, and it's not correct when you think of God in those terms, because it doesn't fit. I am is a continual existence forever in either direction without a base starting point. Are we understanding that? I was isn't right. I always will be isn't. God uses that language, but it's much more correct to say I am in his words. And when God says I am and tries to give it as I would try to give it to these two, it's very hard for me to bring it to them because I just see what I see, and I know about history from 1900s, and the Bible is thousands of years old. For me to try to bring it here is really hard to do. But it doesn't change the fact or the reality. And for us, with our finite minds to grapple with God and the concept of I am, well, we're just too limited. We're just too tiny. But it doesn't change anything about God's I am status. So when you think of that, God being the I am, why did God make us? And what does that mean for us in light of who he is? So it brings us to a pretty, I'm not going to say small, well, I should say small place, but rather than making us small, what I would rather want to do is make God big, because we just are what we are. This is our viewpoint. So I'm not attempting to shrink us into oblivion like a germ. I'm just saying, in light of what we're sitting, what we're looking at, God is to be magnified and expanded beyond anything that we can comprehend, and we try and do that. But why did God make us, and what does that mean for us in light of who he is? Let me read this here. It's about the self-sufficiency of God. The problem of why God created the universe still troubles thinking men. If we cannot know why, we can at least know that he did not bring his worlds into being to meet some unfulfilled need in himself. So it's not that God had a lack and there was something missing and he just had to do this. That's not the case. God is completely self-contained, self-sufficient, and didn't have lack or gaps. As a man might build a house to shelter himself against the winter cold, or plant a field or corn to provide necessary food. So God didn't make the worlds for those reasons. There was no gap or lack in him. The word necessary is wholly foreign to God. God needs nothing. God doesn't need earth. He doesn't need you. He doesn't need corn. The word necessary is foreign to God. It is not in his person, not in his being. He did not need to make the world. There was no lack in him. And since he is being supreme over all, it follows that God cannot be elevated. I love this thought. Since he, capital H, is being supreme over all, as Psalms repeatedly says, it follows that God cannot be elevated. So if he is supreme, there's no going up from there. Nothing is above him. Nothing is beyond him. Any motion in his direction is elevated for the creature. Away from him, descent. So if we take our thoughts and attitudes towards God, we can do nothing but rise because there is nothing higher than God. So no matter where we are in this life, if we're directing our thoughts, our purposes, our plans towards God, they will be upward, period. They just will be because God is high and noble, and anything in his direction is elevation. And for the creature away from him, it's away from our low point, upward. He holds his position out of himself and by leave of no one. It's his own place. No one can promote him, and so no one can degrade him. It is written that he upholds all things by the word of his power. How can he be raised? How can he be supported by things that he upholds? Were all human beings to suddenly become blind, still the sun would shine day by day and the stars by night. So the sun does not care how many eyes see what's going on, or how many eyes use, and if I can put it in words that maybe aren't correct, but how many eyes consume that light and need it and depend on it. the sun is affected zero by that process of 8 billion pairs of eyes needing that light and feeding on it or consuming it, again, in crude words. If everyone were to become blind, the sun would be affected in nothing by us being blind. It would still shine, and the stars by night, exactly in the same way. And that is our God. This is how we are in relation to God. They owe nothing to the millions who benefit from their light. And so were every man on earth to become an atheist, every single one, it would not affect God in any way. Nothing. He is completely, absolutely unchallenged. He is what he is in himself without regard to any other. To believe in him adds nothing to his perfections. Sometimes people think they give God credit by believing him. Or they do something great and they give God the glory when it's really their glory. He doesn't need that. He has no need of that. It doesn't fill something that's lacking in him. It's simply coming to a place of recognition. To believe in him adds nothing to his perfections. To doubt him takes nothing away. I'll read a little bit more here. Almighty God, just because he is almighty, needs no support. The picture of a nervous, ingratiating God fawning over men to win their favor is not a pleasant one. I think it's very disrespectful, in fact. Of a nervous, ingratiating God fawning over men to win their favor is not a pleasant one. Yet if we look at the popular conception of what God is, that is precise, of the popular conception of what God is, that is precisely what we see. 20th century Christianity has put God on charity. So lofty is our opinion of ourselves that we find it quite easy, not to say enjoyable, to believe that we are necessary to God. But the truth is that God is not greater for our being, nor would he be less if we do not exist. That we do exist is altogether of God's free determination, and not by our merit, nor by divine necessity. God simply is. He simply is. And we don't affect that or touch it or alter it or give it pressure. Nothing. God is. So again, there are things here to be mined out that are hard to get, but I hope that we can try and reach and strive and open. And in doing that, God rewards those that seek him. He gives light. He opens the curtain, so to speak, that we can start seeing things through them. And it's something that only he can do. But he is not to be played with. If people are going to play with God, he simply will. He's not to be played with. He's not to be made into something that people imagine him to be. You or me or anyone else. Thinking of it in another way, again, Bob and I being a sort of illustration here, thinking if you would go back a few hundred years, I don't know, to where, maybe AD 600, AD 1000, and give them a Concorde jet. You would somehow take it there and put it in their human sphere, and all of mankind would start exploring that jet. And somehow it would stay there, just imagine. It would stay there for generations and generations and generations and generations, and they would explore it, and they'd find out, what is this? The compound, the round thing. And they'd eventually figure out rubber, and maybe over a few hundred years, paint, and over a few hundred more years, electricity, and that there's electricity going through these things, and then levers and wires. And they start mining things out, and when you do this, this happens, and if you move this, eventually they might even get it fired up and running. Through nothing but simply mining out, what is this thing? And you would apply thousands of minds, thousands of hundreds and hundreds of years to simply, what is this thing? And they would eventually get to the point of understanding, a very basic understanding of it. They'd be able to fire it up, appreciate some of the complexities of it, and they'll be able to move it. And with that, with all that history there, they would write it down and document it and put layer upon layer of knowledge. Why is the paint on there? Because if it's not, it rusts. And they'd figure out that stuff. And eventually, with the Concorde, they'd be able to literally move the thing. So you would think that man, in doing that, in looking at the Concorde, what do you think they would conclude? Can I have any Any ideas? What are their options? What would they be concluding? What would they think about themselves collectively? There's no wrong answer. Anyone, be brave. I know sitting, it feels a lot friendlier up here, but when I'm back there and people ask, I generally shut down, but from here it's a lot friendlier. So if you have any comment, what would people conclude about themselves if after 700 years they get the Concorde moving? What's their mindset on their own world, on their own selves? They would figure out they're pretty smart, because they are. There is a lot to figure out in a Concorde. They think we are wise. We, through discovery, through endless pushing, through endless collaboration, they think that we can, they will now, through discovery, science, we will forge our own destiny, because we're obviously smart enough to figure this out. We are masters of our fate, because we have learned so much about how this thing works. We will apply all we learned and much, much more, and become all wise, and further prove that we have need of nothing. And ultimately, with our wisdom, we will rule supreme. There isn't anything greater than us and science. Is that familiar? Human beings have been studying science, the human body. When you cut yourself, what happens? Hemoglobin levels, blood types, how the eye works, how many million colors the eye can see, what to do when something breaks, how to do open heart surgery. There's many things that the human body is, it's fantastically made. And the more that we find out, we, mankind, find out about the human body, just that, the more complicated it gets, because there's many systems in systems in systems that are completely interconnected and dependent on five other systems. And the more that we as humans mine into that, somehow man thinks more and more we are masters of our fate, because we have learned so much about how this thing works. We will apply all we learned, become all wise, and further prove that we have need of nothing. And ultimately, with our wisdom, rule supreme. There isn't anything greater than us and science. But that is akin, obviously, with the illustration I gave, to them saying, looking at the Concorde and saying, being that we've discovered paint and rubber and fuel mixtures and ratio and ignition, and we can move this thing, being that we've arrived here, obviously there's nothing bigger than us. Obviously we're all powerful. They take that approach, and we as men take that approach, rather than saying, what on earth? The more that we're discovering, the more we're figuring out this is connected to that. And this thing, we've had it for hundreds or thousands of years. That means all the way back there, somebody knew all that stuff. And we in this modern age, when our complete enlightenment that we have currently have not even begun to figure out what somebody knew hundreds of years ago and gave this thing to us as a project to discover. So instead of recognizing, whoa, we are so dumb, we didn't know anything back then, and now that we're discovering more, it's becoming evident. Every time we discover something, it's becoming evident there's something infinitely, in their mind, or far greater, infinite is God, far greater than anything that we ever could come up. All we're doing is scratching at this thing. Who knows what it's for, even? Maybe it flies, this, I don't know what it is, 10,000-pound or 50,000-pound thing. Who knows? That might even be possible. And they start thinking like that, and with that would come a humility, you would think. But instead, mankind says, obviously there's no God because we're discovering science. It is a severely tiny, and dare I use the word correctly, stupid viewpoint. It has to be. It is. Absolutely. I'm going to go to a few passages here. Just, we're not immune from this. I a few years ago, when I was younger, in my 20s, had a fair bit of pressure concerning evolution. I wondered, what if it's true? And that would be what it would do to my religion, to my faith belief. I want my soul to be secure, and I would like purpose in life, and I want there to be a God, and I'm sure there is, but if evolution is true, it's a lot of pressure that I really don't want to deal with. I really, really hope it isn't, but I'm sure creation makes a lot more sense. So that was, if I could put it crudely, my viewpoint. But going to Romans, I know I'm not going to get nearly through my message, but I'm considering this a start anyway, so I'll just kind of have to stop in the middle somewhere. And that's okay, because it's introduction technically. So going to Romans 1, there's words here that I'm generalizing too much. If you're not there, forgive me, but I'm speaking of humankind to everybody and me and you if it applies. I hope no one's offended when I talk like this, when I say we. But in Romans 1, sorry, I'm disoriented here, it talks of mankind and their condition, lists a few things, but it gives an indictment against man, what God would have against man. Romans 1, it says, therein is the righteousness, and I don't believe it's talking of a moral rightness, that you may do these laws and not those laws. I don't think it's talking about that, and I'll get to that later on in the message. So it's therein revealed that the righteousness of God is revealed. So the righteousness simply would be where everything is how it's supposed to be, a car that's running perfectly from the factory. It's just perfect. There's nothing wrong with it. That is righteousness. And if you think of me cutting myself, and in a week later, it's completely healed, you couldn't find it, that everything just works like it should. All the muscles, all the sinew, all the white and red, and everything simply, there's probably, I'm guessing, but I would say millions of things happening to make that happen. They all simply do it like they're supposed to. It's a very righteous act that's happening. There's laws happening that if I cut myself and it self-heals while I'm living and using it, it's a very righteous thing. In other words, things are doing exactly what they're supposed to. So when it says righteousness, it's not necessarily talking about moral law, simply how things are. Gravity, for example, is the way that God operates, and I'll get to that later. There's laws that man observes. It's simply God expressing himself, and God's laws is a bit crude. I like to think of it as God's ways being enacted out. Leaves, cycles, wind cleaning the skies. There are cycles everywhere in nature that completely integrate. It's simply what God every day ordains to be. Birds chirping, migration. There's things simply happening, period. And man has looked at those things and given them names and laws. But it's simply God's world operating just like he wants it to. It's obeying God in righteousness. So think of it that way. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, in that is written, the just shall live by faith, by believing visible things. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. I'll skip forward. It's not my point, but it's valid. For the invisible things from him are, for that which is may be known of God is manifest in them. So there's things that can absolutely be known of God to a thinking, reasoning person. For God that showed it unto them. So what did God show them? How does God charge every human being that ever was that there is a God in heaven? This is blanket to every person that's alive today and has ever been alive. This judgment is on them. Because God had showed it to them. What did God show them? For the invisible things of him from creation of the world. So when the second that time started and God started this project, from that second, it is clearly seen, clearly seen. So if we're giving evolution weight, it just means that the wool has been pulled over our eyes down to about here and we're just seeing a sliver at the bottom. That's all that means. There is absolutely no way in the entire universe, if you had added up with numbers, that this world could be by chance. It simply cannot be. There are no numbers that big, factually. It just cannot be. And when we think it could be, or they have more power, or, oh, I need better arguments, answers in Genesis help, if we're thinking in those terms, we've just been blinded enough that we're starting to believe a big, big, fantastic lie, because there is no way it could be. There just isn't. And if you get into the world of quantum physics, Dennis, maybe your sphere, but there's things happening we don't know about, like two things being able to, this book is here, meaning it's not back there. But in the world of quantum physics, they're finding out, oddly enough, that two things can be at the same place at the same time, because there's something operating over here, and separately over here, when they take this one out, the one completely removed disappears as well, every time. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be able to be that way. And with our finite minds, we can't comprehend it. But something that is happening over here, an entity, and it's completely separated. If they kill this one or take it away, this one disappears instantaneously. If they bring it back, this one is back. And it's not a copy. It's actually the same thing. And those are things, and who knows what else is in there? Who knows what all happens when you throttle up the Concorde enough? Again, maybe it can fly. It's a crazy thought, but maybe this 80,000-pound thing could take off if we studied enough. In God's world, if looked at correctly with true eyes, not eyes of I hope so or we wish so, faith is simply acknowledging what is. So when Abraham or when Noah built his boat in Hebrews, we'll get to that later, there was physical, practical, real evidence. Faith is evidence and substance. It's real things. So when he's saying here that man should know by creation that things are clearly seen, they are understood that God made them in his eternal power and Godhead. That is absolute fact. And when man says there is no God, you are denying this fact, that there are things clearly seen from creation of the world. They're being understood by things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. They are without excuse. There is a God in heaven. And every man that has been born from Adam to the last one born will have to reckon with that fact. There is a God in heaven. And he's not to be played with. He's not to be religiousized. There is a God in heaven. I don't think I will cut necessarily, so I think I'll just go for a little bit more and then stop. I'd like to give a few concepts. So when God uses words like righteousness, we in our human minds, again, I hope I'm not offending anybody. I'm being very general, talking to me. When we say righteousness, we think of moral law, Ten Commandments, what you should do, what you should not do. Instead of thinking in terms of right, how things are exactly like they're supposed to be in God's world in order, and when they're wrong, when they're off what God planned and what God is. So let me give you an example. We went to Brendan and Rebecca's wedding. It was a wonderful time. I'm glad he got married. So we had a wonderful time going there. We borrowed a wonderful van. We had a nice group of people. So let's just give the scenario. So the vehicle's clean. Its oil is changed. The tires are new. It's washed. It's vacuumed. Everything's packed. It's not too full. Everyone has a seat. There are spare seats. The seat belts work. The fuel is clean. Spark plugs are doing just what they should. The engine's got enough power. Windshield's clean. We're heading out. The coffee's hot. It has 2 cream in it. I like it. It's in my cup holder, not in the back seat. The little guy's buckled in. He's happy. The attitudes are good. We're singing songs. We're liking the landmarks. The hum of the tires underneath the interstate. It's just nice. And we're going to the wedding. And you add layer upon layer upon layer of nice. That's just enjoyable and right. We stop for fuel. It's almost empty. We fill up again. There's money to pay for it. It just works. However, we have one more day to be there, and we find out that the sign ahead of us says Portland, Oregon. So no matter how nice our trip is, no matter how things went, no matter how much money we have, if we're not making it to the wedding, the entire trip from the moment we made the first wrong turn until this current second, everything, in a sense, has been not sin, not evil, but just fundamentally wrong. And there's things in life that are not sin, they're not evil, but taken as a package and taken as a whole, they're a complete, utter waste of time and fundamentally wrong. So when we put terms of, am I obeying the Ten Commandments, we can lose so much of what's happening. There are things that are just fundamentally wrong. And again, the world doesn't stop if they happen, but they're a waste, waste, waste. That fuel was wasted, the time was wasted. Now, there's good things in it. I enjoyed the coffee. But to enjoy a coffee when you're not going to be at the wedding has all of a sudden very little value. It's a wasted coffee because I should have not had one and paid attention to where I was going. And so we start unpacking it, but it's fundamentally just wrong. Let me say it a different way. There are things in life that happen all around us that just are, and we take them for granted. and thinking of a clothing company, there are some massive, massive clothing companies. When I say clothing, I'm not talking Carhartt or work clothing. Like, human beings need clothing. There should be a clothing industry. I think it's a good and healthy thing. But there's another industry that would be the fashion industry, which its sole purpose is to make consumable clothing. And it's meant to be worn for about, I think the average is 2 to 4 weeks. Then it's discarded, literally. And they ship it by the shiploads overseas because it's simply discarded clothing. It's not meant to be worn long term. Its lifespan is about a month. There is an unbelievably massive industry in consumable clothing. I'll simply call it fashion. So I'm not talking about a normal shirt that you wear to Sunday morning. It might overlap, but when I'm talking fashion, I'm talking of that world that's consumable, meant to be for style, for show, for visual. They've got it, so we need it. This is brand. This celebrity had it, so we flock to it. That whole movement. So it is a multi, I think the top 10 brands are worth, I think, $250 billion. Again, this is not using clothing, usable. It's fashion. $250 billion. If you think of the ramifications of that, there are systems that are mind-boggling. In the old days, they would make clothing overseas usually, ship it back here, try it, try the style, try the color. Is it selling? Is it not? Look at the trends, and it would be by the 6 month turnaround time till they figure out what to do with this clothing. Where are the trends going? Which colors are good? What is selling? What isn't? So it'd be very, very expensive because you're trying all these things and you find out this vein works. So they pursue this vein and they pursue it long enough till it starts losing steam. And in the meantime, they figure out this one works. It's a very long, expensive process. So what's happening these days, and this is slightly old information, but the tills here in Polo Park are, they have Lyatt. There's a massive conglomerate company that owns many, many small ones. But as they're selling here in Polo Park, when you buy a fashion item, it'll trigger what it is, what style, what model, where it was made, and just track it, trend it with algorithms. And as certain things buy and sell out and peak, they'll put pressure on to the designers back in Bangladesh, wherever it is, and they'll design something in this line, in this vein, real time. Like the next day, they start designing it because this is going, this is moving up. So their designers, the next day, not 6 months later when the tracks are in, because things are climbing, we design something new, we make it 3 days later, and it's shipped to America in a week. So we don't have a 6 month process. From your sale yesterday, next week, stuff starts showing up here that's based on what you bought. And those trends are powerful. The sales are astronomical. Billion is a big number. That is a lot of paying rent spaces in the mall and cleaning people that clean that stuff and store shelf stockers. I did that. And truck drivers, all this stuff in. And thousands of people in Bangladesh and China making that stuff, feeding their families. There's positive spin-off because it's work, but on the other hand, it's poverty work, dangerous. But if you think of the words billion and 250 billion spin-off from the fashion industry, I can't compute how big that is. And all the effort and time and the CEOs and the corporate jets and the what all is involved in that number. It's astronomical. But fundamentally, when God made man in his own glory, and man is wanting glory by themselves, I've got a brown, my arms are browner than yours, therefore I'm better than you, and man is trying to do that all the time, step on each other to be bigger. That whole 250 billion, those are just the top 10 companies, there's many more. That whole entire industry, fundamentally, is then wrong. A complete and utter waste of time. Everything. Completely. By a simple concept of God applying God's truth to something in our life, and that entire thing is wrong. And when we get to heaven with the short time that we have, what are we putting our time into? So are we like the guy sitting in his minivan looking at me and saying, oh no, and then we say, too much to handle, this is too life-altering, where's my phone, where's my coffee, I need to tune this out. And that's generally what man will do. It's too big, too colossal, and we just simply can't deal with it. And they switch it off. And we don't take the word of God seriously when he says things about us, what we should be doing, your life effort. So I have a lot more to say. I'll maybe do part two next time. I just wanted to bring some introduction. But in closing, I do want to do a few more things here. in God. And next time we'll get to more of who God is. But man must find his place before an almighty, eternal, unchanging, self-sufficient, omnipresent, pure, good, just, and holy God. God is defined by himself. And whatever fellow fallen men or evil men, and there's a big difference between a carnal, simply earthly man walking out his walk and an evil man, a rebel, there's many out and they're increasing, or well-meaning but erroneous religious people, whatever they come up with, it does nothing to who God is. None of them change it. If we're completely wrong about who God is, it does nothing to alter it. We lose. So it's in our best interest to get an accurate view of who God is. He will not be played with. He will not adjust to what people think he is. He's unchanging. He can't change up, down, sideways, because that would mean he'd have to become more. He cannot become more. Or he would have to become less. He cannot become less. He simply is. He will not change. He will not be reduced. He will not be manipulated. He says, I am that I am. And the wonderful thing is with his, if I make 90 million of these things, ultimately, if I want to burn 90 million of them, I could, and not have a pang of conscience about it. And ultimately, as big as God is, he does not have to regard us. If he wants to take 100,000 and use us for some purpose, he legitimately could, because we're just, in light of who he is, we're not even this. If you think of every blade of grass, we don't think of a sand grain as being living, but there's living things and blade of, or maybe I can put it different things that need, no, I'll just leave that. So, yeah, another whole concept. But every living blade of grass, every atom, molecule, air, all over the entire world, the stars, the galaxies, God is there and bigger. So we're not even, the illustration, this is very wrong, because I'm too close to these to put myself in light of God. So this illustration from me to them is too small. The gap is far too narrow for me to compare to me and God. God is infinitely bigger than this tiny illustration. So this is wrong because its scale is too small. But the nice thing is, he is not one that will simply because he can clear off 2 million of men when he doesn't like them or they challenge him. His goodness, his mercy, his justice is as big as he is. And he regards tiny, finite, little men. And those that seek him, he promises he will reveal. But again, he's not going to be played with. If you play with him, you get zero. He doesn't enter, he's not interested in that. Those that play at God will not find him, but the serious seeker, he's promised will. He will reveal himself. It's not a game. It's not a feel-good thing. So the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So just one more thing in closing here. So knowledge of such a being cannot be gained by study alone. It comes by a wisdom the natural man knows nothing of, neither can know, because it's spiritually discerned. Jesus said the things of the flesh and the things of the spirit do not comprehend each other. They don't reach, they don't connect. But the man can take his flesh and seek God, and God will illuminate and open up and show and reveal. So we cannot know, but we can spiritually discern if God condescends to show us. To know God is at once the easiest and the most difficult thing in the world. It is easy because knowledge is not won by hard mental toil. It is something freely given. As sunlight falls free on an open field, so the knowledge of a holy God is a free gift to men who are open to receive it. But this knowledge is difficult because there are conditions to be met, and the obstinate nature of fallen man does not take kindly to them. We'd still like to have things our way. If God is this way, then... And that language does not apply to God. It comes from a humble heart, taking God exactly where he places us at, finding our place there, and honestly starting an actual seeking that is real. So may God reward us with that. I'll take my men home. They live to tell the tale. and they served their purpose, so all worked well. Amen.